This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, folks, let's go ahead and call this meeting to order now. We're a couple minutes past our usual 4:32. So we'll call today's meeting of the University Assembly to order, and I will turn it over to Casey to do roll call for us.
Ian Apicello.
Here.
Valerie Amer.
Here.
Marcy Benda. She will be a few minutes late. Richard Benzel.
Here.
Ben Kading.
I'm just chilling. Yeah, I'm here.
Nicola Dana. Nicola Dana.
Not here.
Not here. Eve DeRosa. Jacob Veit.
Here.
Brent Fortenberry.
Here.
Hans Fox.
Here.
Justin Hanley.
Here.
David Heiner. Deborah Howell. Carolyn Levine. Yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah. Manaya Lewis. Donnelly Anonye.
Here.
James Richards.
Running a few minutes late.
Damien Sharp.
Here.
Jessica Withers.
Here.
All right, we'll now do the land acknowledgement here. Cornell University is located on the traditional homeland of the Gayagono, the Piuga Nation. The Gayagono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayagono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayagono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. And with that, before we do a call for a late addition, I just want to acknowledge that I may have to step out at some point during the meeting if I receive a phone call. And if I do so, I will just pass over to Jacob and take over. But don't foresee that happening, hopefully. With that, then we'll move to a call for late additions to the agenda. I recognize Jacob.
I do have a late addition to the agenda. I did not get in on time. University Assembly Resolution Number 3 regarding the smart waste technology.
A motion to add University Resolution 3 as a late addition. We have a second.
Second.
Any discussion?
I'm sure we can get that on the screen.
Sorry. Yes, I have it here. Any opposition? We'll go with the unanimous. Any opposition to that? Seeing none, we'll add that as a late addition to the agenda. With that, then, we will move to our business of the day, and I'm excited to welcome the Director for the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, Christina Liang. Thank you for joining us, Christina. And Christina has a presentation, and we'll be moving up to the front of the room, and let me just get our screen share going to make sure I got it right. This is always the trick part of it. The other part is Zoom screen share PowerPoint. Did I do it
right? Click over so you can just put it on
all advanced. I will say click.
How's that? Yeah, that's okay. Thank you. I'm gonna head to the front.
Yeah.
How's everyone doing today? Okay. Awesome. Hi there. Well, I want to thank everybody for sharing your space. I know sometimes your agendas, thank you, are always packed, and so I appreciate this, the opportunity for an invitation to share with you some of the really awesome things that we're doing in terms of managing a new student code of conduct and the conduct process. So, but my name is Christina Liang. I use the pronouns she, her, and I currently serve as your director of the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. I've been in that role since August. I've been at Cornell for about 6.5 years, all within student conduct, and kind of overseeing some of the changes that we've been seeing the past year. So, just a kind of a quick recap, the timeline of our new office, the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards, OSCCS for short. I know it's a mouthful, so the Student Conduct Office is totally fine. And the new code, a couple of things that happened last June. It worked for like a second. Okay, there we go. All right, just need a little convincing. So Our office transitioned last July, so we used to be known as the Office of the Judicial Administrator, or the JA's office, and so that office is no more. I've been kind of using this time this year to say JA no more. We've moved on to a new office, so this is who we are, and that was July 1st of 2021. And about a month later, we adopted a new code, and it's called the Student Code of Conduct. The previous policy was known as the Campus Code of Conduct, and that transition happened on August 2nd. And so we've been implementing this new code now for just over 7 months. And so this is a great time for us to talk to you about some of the things that we've noticed in the past 7 months. In that time, our office has expanded, and so we went from an office of 5 to an office of 9, and so we're really grateful for kind of the support we've received to really expand our office to do really amazing work. So the main expansion you'll see here is the assistant director position. That is a new role, and we hired 3 assistant directors that started in January. Their primary responsibility is to resolve cases that kind of come through our office, reports that we receive. And that actually gave a lot of room for our associate directors to do things like create assessment plans, right? To do some sanctioning models, things like that, things that we never really had a lot of time to do in the past. We also added a hearing chair position. And the hearing chair's role is really to oversee the hearing process. They work with our university hearing and review panel. And so for those of you who are part of that panel, Karen Bix is probably a name that you're all familiar with. And that is our entire team. And I'd be remiss to not mention the student codes counselors, who are not part of our office, but they serve a very important role in the student conduct process. And these are law school students who work with both respondents and complainants to provide advisement and support. And they're a free resource, which I think is really, really great for Cornell. And we've been building a lot of ongoing relationships and collaborations with them throughout this year. So over the summer, we created a vision and a mission, and kind of a silly, corny joke that we've been running around asking people is, you know, who knows what the mission and vision was for the Office of the Judicial Administrator? And it's kind of a trick question because we really didn't have one. And for me, I think our team recognized that we want to be really intentional about the things that we're doing, and so creating a mission, the idea of what we hope one day aspirationally will be, and what our mission is, what we do right now, is really important to us. And so our vision, so we want to create an educational and restorative student experience that upholds both community development, right, because we are all part of a bigger community, and also to promote personal development, right, for students and student organizations. We want students to be able to grow and learn from the process. Our mission is to promote a responsible and respectful campus community through prevention education and by supporting individuals who are navigating conflict in a transparent, fair, and equitable process. That's a mouthful, but I think I've bolded some of the key terms here that we really wanted to focus on. Prevention education from the perspective of, why don't we do things proactively, right, to prevent things like conflict and concerns from coming up in the first place. And we know humans aren't perfect, and so when students are navigating the conduct process, we want to make sure it's a fair one, an equitable one, and one that is fair and transparent as well. So that's our mission and vision. We also created student learning outcomes, and this is connected to the idea that we want to create an assessment plan, right, to identify whether or not we're actually doing the things that we say we're doing. And I'm not going to read all of these to you, but, you know, regardless of if people are engaging with our office by, you know, requesting a training or perhaps engaging in this way, right, welcoming me to a presentation, whether they're participating in the conduct process as a respondent, as a complainant, as a witness, or they're reflecting upon their experience, we want students to learn, right? That's really, at the end of the day, the core of why we think our office exists and what we're trying to do through the conduct process. Okay. So you're probably wondering, right, Christina, you talked about this new code, this new office, so what exactly happens now, right, when there is a report to OSCCS under the new code? Well, I'm really glad that you asked, or you didn't really, but I'm going to tell you anyways. I want to just briefly touch on the steps in the conduct process, all right? Everything starts with an incident report, right? We're not going out looking for, like, hey, something looks concerning in the community, right? Usually people submit reports to our team, and the first thing that we do is we triage it within our office. Triage is kind of a fancy way of saying we look at the report and we determine, is this something that falls under a policy, right? Because sometimes things are reported to our team that maybe shouldn't be reported to our team. An example, a really good example, is sometimes we get gender-based misconduct that's reported to our office, and sometimes it's just misreported, right? And that's something that we share back with the Title IX office instead so that they can kind of take care of it under policy 6.4. That's an example, right? After we kind of triage it, we're thinking, okay, this is probably potentially a code of conduct violation. We're not really sure. The next thing we actually do in the new code is we triage it with a complainant. And a complainant is a person or a representative, a staff member, who is saying, okay, there was a community that was affected by this behavior, potentially affected, and we want their perspective on helping to resolve this. And this, I think, if I can pause for a second, is really what's significantly different about the new code. Okay? In the past, and I would say a lot of different institutions around the country, they have a conduct process where it's the people who work in the conduct team deciding things, right? The process is happening to people. Our code of conduct emphasizes a complainant and a respondent coming together collectively to resolve a potential issue that's come up in our community. And so there's ownership, right, within community members on how we can resolve this. And the methods of resolution are, there's really just two, formal process or informal process. And it's the choice of the complainant and the respondent, okay? The formal process would start what's called an investigation, where there's information collecting, information gathering, leading up to a hearing process where the university hearing and review panel would determine an outcome. A group of people would review all the information and decide what the outcome should be. And that's that blue box there. The yellow box is an informal resolution option. And this is where the complainant and the respondent agree to try to reach a resolution outside of a formal hearing process. And the reason there's that kind of rainbow umbrella there is I really want to emphasize informal resolution is an umbrella category. There's actually a whole host of different methods of resolution available under this category. And you're like, well, what are those, Christina? Well, I'm going to tell you. Right now, we have four available to students. There's the summary resolution, resolution meeting, restorative mediation, restorative justice conference. And I can go on and on about these at another presentation, perhaps, but I wanted to tell you that there are multiple options because guess what? Our community is vast. Students learn differently. Students have different levels of investment and engagement. Right? And so it's really important for us to create different types of resolution methods that cater to the different learning styles our students have. And so you'll see here some of these options are, they're more transactional type of resolution options. There are other options that are very involved and require time and meeting with different people, stakeholders, impacted parties to repair the harm and build trust within the community. So these are the different options that we currently have under the umbrella category that I was just sharing before. All right, so this is a little graphic I found that basically is, what I'm trying to say is, what have we learned in the past 7 months, right? Some of the themes that I wanted to share and distill from the past 7 months for you. One of them is that the code really emphasizes this complainant and respondent-driven process. The conduct office, our team, is now really there to help community members reach an agreeable resolution. And for those who may have been a little bit more familiar with the previous process, this is really different, right? Because the conduct team, the folks who are part of the JA's office, were really in that position to help make decisions, right? And here, we're actually more of a facilitator. Right? Strong collaborations with campus partners are really important because student conduct is a community concern, right? Our students, they are very involved, and they may be residential students. They may be participating in a student organization. And so resolving something with just that one student without including the folks who have also been impacted is really not going to work out, right? And so we've built really strong relationships with the Office of Sorority, Fraternity Life, for example, Campus Activities, Housing and Residence Life. These are some of the community partners that we've been working with. Our restorative and educational conduct process requires time and investment in intentional and effective resolutions. And so, you know, restorative practices and restorative justice work takes time, right? And I think that for us, what has really been important is not to rush the process, right? And taking the time to make sure all the parties who should be involved in the conversation are asked to participate. Since the code is still new to our community, we recognize that we need to continue to teach the conduct process to the community. We need to be part of that conversation of rebuilding trust with our community about how we do student conduct work. And so, again, just very grateful that I'm being invited to this space to kind of give you a status update on how things are going. All right. So I want to share some data points from August 2nd to now, specifically February 28th. So this is data all through the past 7 months for what has been reported to our office, how we've been managing things. So the number of reports that our office received, 457, is fairly on track with the volume that our office previously experiences. And what's really great now is we have more staff. So we're hopeful that this will actually kind of help speed up the process and help us respond to things more contemporaneous to when things are happening. You'll see here the number of cases that qualify for Good Samaritan Protocol is 71. And for those who may not be familiar, the Good Samaritan Protocol provides conduct immunity to students when someone calls for help as it pertains to either alcohol consumption or an adverse response to alcohol or drug use. And that number is huge, right? Because what that means is that there were 71 students where another community member was like, you need help, we need to focus on getting you help. And we provided immunity to those students because we want to make sure that we are encouraging people to call for help, right? To look out for one another. And those 71 students received support from our office, but also from the university by providing them some alcohol education as well. Okay. Number of cases that were actually open for a conduct process is 386. Now, you'll notice those numbers are a little bit lower, right, than that 457 number, and that's reflective of what I talked about a little bit earlier. Sometimes things are reported to our office that don't fall under the code of conduct, so we don't open every single case that is reported to our team. The number of cases resolved through the informal process is 260, and the number of cases going through the formal process is 6. Now you're like, whoa, those numbers are really different. Well, I think the code is written in that way. It's intentional to have a lot of different options under the informal process for students to want to engage in. And so you'll see that the formal investigation process, those numbers will be relatively small. Okay. And just for clarity, that 260 is the number of resolved cases already. There are, of course, cases that are still pending and ongoing towards that path to resolution. Okay. Number of reports involving student orgs is 376. And involving student orgs, which is also under the code of conduct, is 10. Okay, so that's just some data points related to reports and resolution type. The most common types of violations reported to our office: alcohol-related behavior, underage consumption, possession, public intoxication, failure to comply with the rule or a policy, misrepresentation, falsified documents. This is our fake ID provision under the code. We also have property damage, theft, unauthorized entry, drug possession, and fire safety. And so these types of behaviors are actually fairly consistent with probably a lot of institutions of similar size and demographic as Cornell. And maybe a theme that you might identify is that these are behaviors that might likely represent a moment in time where there is a lapse in judgment, right? And so that's really helpful for us to identify these as trends in terms of what types of education we can provide to the community to help prevent either its occurrence or recurrence, right? And so it's helpful for us to gather what types of behaviors are showing up within the Cornell community. I also wanted to share the most common sanctions or outcomes that we're utilizing in our office. We've really moved away from punitive and inequitable sanctions. So things like written reprimands, which would create a disciplinary record for a student, we've really moved away from those. And things like monetary fines, right, recognizing that $50 to one person means something completely different to another person. And instead, these are the types of sanctions you'll be seeing for students who go through the conduct process. Individualizing sanctions has been something that's really important to us, so I'll use an example. This reflective exercise, sanctioned there up top, it's not always a paper, right? We have a lot of really creative and artistic students. I've actually seen a lot of really great reflective sanctions in the form of a song, right? Or some type of painting. And for us, it's really important that students want to reflect in a way that's meaningful to them. Something I used to say to students when I was resolving one-on-one cases, is I don't want to read a reflection paper that you didn't want to write. Like, that's also not something that I would enjoy. And so if you would rather put together some type of reflection in a different way, I'm really open to it. And students are really kind of ticking up on us on that offer because it's showing that we're invested in them learning something from the process. So that's an example I'll share. So I also wanted to share what students are saying about the process. And these are some testimonials that are taken from our reflection exercises from our students who went through the process. So I've learned that these policies are in place for important reasons: to protect students from dangerous situations and environments, and to limit the possibility of dangerous situations being created. What caught my attention about this, I think, is that, you know, students are recognizing that policies exist, why they exist, and that it's not to necessarily eliminate all possible dangerous situations, but really to limit them, right, to create a safe environment for all Cornellians. Some other quotes. I definitely have a new perspective and realize that my actions have a big impact on the community around me. I will be more conscious of my actions and will be a better community member. And what was meaningful for me when I read that was, this is a student who was able to identify, my actions are not just my actions. Like, there are ripple effects in terms of how it affects other community members, and specifically, what am I going to do differently in the future, right? Steps that I'm going to take to be a better community member in the future. Another quote I'll share: ultimately, I do not regret this experience, which was referencing the student conduct experience. I'm thankful for the kindness and guidance of those involved and believe in an important experience in my life. And that might be something that I really hang on to when I'm reading this type of reflection, because, you know, conduct processes for a lot of students, right, whether it's their first experience with working with a process like this, it can be anxious, right, or anxiety provoking, a scary experience. And for us to be able to have a student talk about the kindness that was offered in the process and the guidance that was offered through the process while they're able to reflect and learn and grow from the experience is exactly the conduct process that we envision creating at Cornell when we transition to the new student code of conduct. So that those are some quotes I wanted to share. So what's working? We're rebranding the conduct office, and we're implementing an educational conduct process, right? We're doing those things. We're having more informal options to resolve the conduct issue. We've expanded our office so that we're able to better serve our community's needs. And we're collaborating more with our campus partners, including doing a lot more training at the beginning of each semester at strategically so that we can address concerns proactively. Kind of things that are in the works, right? Things that we're going to be continuing to work on in the next couple of months and year. We're trying to find efficiency in a process that takes time, right? Recognizing that resolution is something that might bring closure to all the parties who are impacted. We want to try to find as much efficiency as possible. We are creating more prevention education for students and also student organizations. So one of the things we're doing is we're creating kind of like a Cornell calendar of behavior, right? Where are times in the year where we might see particularly specific behaviors show up? Well, maybe we do some prevention education through training right before those moments, right? So that we can kind of help students make the best decisions that they can. We're developing creative sanctions for common violations. An example of this is we continue to see risky alcohol consumption within our student population, and this could be potentially connected to coming out of COVID, or as we slowly come out of COVID. And so what are the types of sanctions that are going to be effective in addressing this? Your more traditional alcohol education may not be the only way to go, right? We're thinking about decision making. We're thinking about harm reduction and how to address risk assessment for our students. We're also updating our website. And so some of the things that we're going to be working on this semester, we're going to post FAQs for students so that, you know, when they get that letter from our office that's like, hey, we really want to talk to you about this report we received, there may be a lot of feelings. They should be able to go to our website or through a social media account and navigate the process just by reading and doing their little bit of research, right? And finally, we want to create even more informal resolution options, right? Those four yellow squares are not going to cut it, right, for our diverse student population. And so for us, this is a first year to explore what those options look like. What are some of the gaps that we could potentially fill and create more informal resolution options in the future? That's the end of my presentation. I want to really thank you all for sharing some space and time and just putting up some contact information there. But we are in 120 Day Hall. Word on the street is we have the best candy in that building, and we have great coffee. I'm seeing some nods. Thank you for the affirmation.
That's
awesome. I'm sure our admin is going to be very excited to hear that. So come on in, and you know we can always grab a cup of coffee or just chit chat with our team. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Christina. So we'll now open the floor for questions for Christina. And so I'll welcome the viewers to raise your placards or raise your virtual hands if you'd like to ask a question. We'll start with Ian, and then I'll move in and then
Thank you very much for the presentation. My question concerns, in the event that, say, a claimant elects a formal resolution process and a respondent favors an informal resolution process or vice versa, what is the adjudicatory process to decide which one takes place?
Sure. That's a great question. So we always start with the informal resolution process because that is the way that there's much more collaboration, right, between the different parties. And we always think that when there are people who are impacted by the behavior making collective decisions together, that's always the preferred method versus in the formal resolution process where a hearing panel is kind of deciding, right, what happens. But it only works if the parties agree, right? And so in the event that, you know, you might have a complainant or a respondent who elects to go to the formal resolution process, that would be the way that we would proceed. I did not kind of get in the weeds with our graphic there, but there is something under the formal resolution process called an alternate resolution. An alternate resolution is basically an offering from the hearing process that is still available after a formal complaint is signed, where the parties are able to work with me, actually, to reach a resolution short of a hearing process. So there is still something available. And sometimes I would say, you know, the formal investigation, sometimes it's good to gather some additional information to help reach that resolution, right? And so the investigation can actually be a helpful tool to encourage the parties to reach a resolution. Yeah.
Emily?
Yeah, I have a few questions, so maybe I'll just ask the first one. But just a follow-up from that, is there a situation where, like, two students who might have had, like, maybe, like, the same infraction or something along those lines could have, like, very drastically different, like, consequences or circumstances to a situation?
So I think that it's each individual student is a different person, right? And so that can be an area where there can be different outcomes because what's meaningful to one person, right, is not as meaningful to another person. In a lot of the informal resolution options that we have, our office is still part of that process to provide some guidance, right? So, for example, if there's a scenario where someone says, you know, I think it'd be great if a person did 200 community service hours. Well, the other party could say, okay, sure, that sounds reasonable, right? It's actually not permitted under the code, right? It is, there's a maximum number, and I think it's 80. You can fact check me on that. But I think it's our role in that specific situation is to recognize that there are parameters within our policy, right? And also, I think, to set realistic expectations, right? 200 hours for one person is like, oh, yeah, well, I volunteer all the time, right? But we know also that Cornell students are super involved, and what might be realistic at one moment in time may not truly be feasible or meaningful later on down the road. So I think there can be differences in terms of, you know, the same behavior resulting in different outcomes, but I think that there are mechanisms in place to kind of help create some level of consistency.
Thank you, Emily. If we have time, we'll come back to you. I'll go to Jacob. And then
did you want to follow up?
No, it's fine. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, so, well, I certainly appreciate you coming here today, and I'm a fervent believer in restorative justice. You know, after all, we're an educational institution, right? So we should be prioritizing learning and experiences of personal growth. Mm-hmm. My question is, in analyzing the resolution process, it seems as though, and this is a complaint that I've heard from many students, but the informal resolution process essentially incentivizes a plea of guilt when that might not entirely be the case, just so the student can get the entire case off their back, so to speak. Mm. And it seems that in those cases of informal resolution, there isn't a full hearing on the merits to determine the extent to which an individual is actually guilty.
Yeah.
And so, you know, of course, restorative justice approaches are ideal, but they're only ideal so far as they address actual instances of harm in our community. And adequately assessing the extent of that harm is key, in, as I'm sure you know through your work, in adequately addressing those harms.
So I think that looking at our conduct process and how we approach restorative justice requires us, right, to really disrupt maybe traditional feelings about a conduct process that uses terminology like, you know, are you guilty? Are you responsible, right? When we're looking at RJ, we're trying to repair harm, and harm can extend beyond a specific violation of the code of conduct. And so what I'm trying to say is there actually can be, right, an informal resolution option where the parties agree there's no violation of the code of conduct, but there's been hurt, right? There are times when somebody may say something or exhibit behavior that is not a violation of our policy, but there are experiences that have been negatively impactful for the other party. And so we can still repair those harm through an outcome of not responsible that both parties agree to. But maybe in this instance, it's an opportunity to acknowledge or apologize, right? And to talk about, help me understand why this particular behavior was impactful for you, right? Maybe it's a learning experience in that way. So I think I would challenge, right? I appreciate, like, if there are students who are having this experience of, like, I feel like I'm, you know, being kind of pushed toward this informal process because, you know, the formal process is not something I want to do. Well, first of all, the informal process is only an option if all the parties agree.
Okay.
Right? And so, you know, I think earlier it was Ian, right? I think it was presenting the idea of, well, what happens if a respondent's like, I want to go the informal route, but a complainant wants to go the formal route, right? They're on equal footing in terms of decision making on how to resolve it. So that's one piece I would say. The second piece I would say is, even in the informal process, there can be absolutely an outcome of not responsible.
Right.
Yeah, and that I think is a space maybe we as a team can be better about. Training our staff to make sure we make that clear to our students who are participating in the process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in cases where criminal activity is exhibited in such an instance where it violates local, state, or federal law, are those students or community members, well, students now, held duly responsible both by the university and under the code of law? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are parallel processes that can exist, and that's because what is a violation of local laws, right, might be also a violation of community expectations within the Cornell community. And so, yes, there can be parallel processes that happen at the same time because our process is an administrative process, right, not a criminal justice process. I like to think that our process is a lot more restorative, a lot more educational. We seek to provide an opportunity for students to be heard and to kind of share their perspective as to what happened in this situation. It is, I think, up to students. There are provisions in the code that recognize that a student might be managing the criminal justice system at the same time as our process, and there are mechanisms for us to pause. There are mechanisms for us to acknowledge that.
Understood.
Too. So sometimes students, for example, in really serious cases, they may take a personal leave. Right, and so their status at Cornell kind of pauses, and they can elect to pause the conduct process or to resolve it at a later time.
Understood.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll go to Duncan, and then I have Richard now.
I'll keep it short because I can tell there's a lot of questions here, but I'd love if you could talk a little bit more about the role of the student code counselors, especially in reference to how that's changed from past experiences and what the responsibility and relationship looks like to a student involved in this process on both sides.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the past, when we were using the campus code of conduct, our relationship with the student codes counselor more so worked with respondent code counselors. And that's because the previous code, I would say, didn't always emphasize acknowledging the complainant's role and their impact, right? The new code really tries to identify a harmed party, a complainant, and a respondent in every single case.
Sure.
And so a very concrete change I can share is that in all of our
lists of resources, we always make sure that a complaint is aware of the specific resource of a complaint codes counselor, and the same for the respondent. Under the code, right, the both parties have the right to bring a support person and also an advisor, and so we've seen the code counselors being used in that specific way.
Okay.
In our policy under the code, there's also specific language that talks about required training for the code counselors, and so that has been a really great mechanism for us to do specific training on things like implicit bias, right? Recognizing that we're all part of this structure and we all bring our lived experiences into the space. How we can best support students, I think, is a really important piece that we've done some training on, and collaborating them with so that they can also participate in the trainings that we offer to hearing panels has been ways that we've been working with them. And I would say that that's an expansion of what we used to do.
Sure.
And I'm noticing Susanna's on the call too, and I definitely don't want to put her on the spot, but I think that, you know, if, you know, she can also shed light on that too.
It just sounds like a really interesting procedure, yeah. So thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, absolutely.
And Susanna, if you'd like to add anything to that, you're welcome to.
Hi, everyone. I think Christina talked about most of it. I would just emphasize that our office is still independent. We're still free. We're still a confidential resource for students. So those sort of core elements of support, we still do. There's a new code that we're navigating and learning about as the differences in the code as the code has shifted. We're also learning about those shifts and support, but we're still supporting students. Mm-hmm. It's just in navigating a process that looks a little different this year.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Susanna. And I'll recognize Richard.
Did you have another?
Oh, no worries. Go ahead. I'll go after you.
Okay. So some of the questions, Christy, I think, you know, I knew how the code operated before and so forth, and really interested in how it operates now. But some of the questions, I think Jake's question, Emily's first question about equal justice or equal violations.
Okay.
It seems kind of soft here, in the sense that early on in the process, there should be someone involved, and Susanna can help with this, but someone involved who knows what the practices are for different violations, what the norms are. Mm-hmm. It's a really difficult thing. I don't envy you your office, but it has this quality of kind of parental, you know, expectation. And you always have this feeling that, you know, you don't really like too much. Some parents like some children better than others. So you'd like to have something that controls that kind of, or softens that kind of thing. So it's something I think that the code committee, you know, we should really look at a little bit. I think some of those protections were lost in the shift from the old code to the new one.
So I apologize if I'm not understanding your question. You know, I think that the new code is emphasizing the opportunity for the conduct office to be in a different role, right? Because I think this transition happened. You know, for all intents and purposes, I think there was concerns that the conduct office was approaching conduct work in more of a prosecutorial role. There were a lot of parallels under the old code of conduct that followed a criminal justice system, and there are disparities and equities and elements of oppression under that process that I think we wanted to move away from. We were able to do so while still observing the really important fundamental fairness principles that we honor and offer to our respondents, while balancing, I think, the importance of engaging our complainants, people who have been specifically harmed by the behavior. And so
you know, it's a work in progress, right? This is the first iteration of a policy that is meant to kind of be have an evolution, right, based on our student population, the needs of our students. But I don't know that there are, I guess what I'm not following 100% is what you're describing as the potential softness or the inequities that you might observe from how the process has changed.
Yeah, you were describing it a little bit. Okay. To one person, 200 hours is this, you know, a lot, and somebody else is a lot. You know, that shouldn't be a part. It should be, this is the violation, this is what you get. Mm-hmm. And different people respond to, these things are high pressure for a student. They're at a complaint against them. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about harm, but the complaint itself is hard. So part of the restoration is, you know, to adjust depending. You know, some people are really guilty and they're bad. So some people get a complaint and it's not really justified. It's a misinterpretation of conduct or something. That complaint then is harmed. And you, the way you described it was only one way. And I think the process needs a little bit more work. I would like to see, for example, from what I understand, the respondent codes counselor role expanded a bit and early so that they get a better than the student who is complained against, has a better understanding of how the process works, what the norms are, and what their rights might be. That's the part that my understanding, that was a resistant by the judicial code counselors at the beginning. And I don't
If I can provide a little bit of clarification, the point in time when the respondent's code counselor resource and the complaint code's counselor resource is shared is the first communication that we share with students. Right? So it's not the case that, you know, you don't know about this resource until, say, the formal hearing process or when there's an informal process, you know, determined that we're going to move forward. That's the first communication, the first information that they would receive along with a list of resources for students. You know, I appreciate what you're saying, Richard, about, you know, the potential harms that you perceive that then may be skewed in one direction. And I'll be clear, right? The opportunity to resolve this identifies harms from all parties involved, right? Not just from a complaint perspective or respondent perspective. It could be a broader community. There could be witnesses and people who are in neither one of those roles who may experience harm too. And the flexibility that our code of conduct provides addresses engages all of those community members to be part of it. I'm hopeful that our FAQs that we're about to post will provide a lot of answers to questions that students probably have, right? What happens, right? What does it mean to have some type of record, right? These are questions that a lot of students have that we should be able to answer. And so whereas we won't be able to say, like, textbook, if this happens, then this happens, right? Because I don't believe that's effective education. Deterrent and fear is not a way that students really learn effectively. I can acknowledge and recognize that having some level of, like, I'm not going to get expelled, right? Like, that's reassuring for a student, and that's definitely something that in our FAQs we'll be able to address and hopefully help ease some of that things.
So I think we had said Emily would go with another question, but you have one from Damien. So I'd like to, just out of time for us, to take one more question. So
yeah.
If we have time, then we'll continue.
Yeah, and I just wanted to, like, reiterate, like, thank you so much for coming, and I honestly really do think that this restorative model is just, like, so good for students. Like, I've seen, like, a really, like, powerful change. Another question that I had was kind of, like, this idea that, like, what you were just talking about of, like, this anxiety. I know that, like, when in the JA process, there was a lot of, like, stress around turnaround time, which I think took a long time to get, like, a resolution, especially, like, with cases that I did with residential life, where like sometimes students would spend like 3 months in this process, yeah. and it would be like really like intimidating for them. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you've seen like turnaround time decrease in this model, or if there's like ways that you're like working to like assist students that are going through these processes.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when we first adopted this model, there was an acknowledgement that restorative practices take more time. Mm-hmm. And that's because when you engage more partners and more people to participate in the process, you, at the very minimum, you have to take into consideration the logistics of coordinating a meeting time for multiple people, right? And so I think that there was an anticipation at the forefront that there may be a delay in resolution or the adjudication timeline. We were able to add 3 assistant directors in January, and so they're fully trained now, and even within the month of February, we saw a lot more cases being resolved. And so, to me, I think the timeline for resolution is an important metric. It is no longer, for me, the only metric of success, right? We want people to be able to resolve things, you know, based on where they're at in the process. We don't want to rush the process. We want to make sure that folks have an opportunity to share their perspective. But it is definitely something that, as we look at our monthly data, we're paying close attention to.
And if you have time, Christine, I think we can take one more question.
Christine, thanks for being here today. I think Richard brings up a good point in kind of just the possibility of an inequity. And so, but I understand that your answer to that, and that you're looking at this monthly data to kind of review that. So is there a long-term plan to kind of evaluate this new policy to see if it is coming out inequitable?
Yeah. So our office is required to share an annual report. And so that is something that we want to utilize as a transparency tool for the community to show whether the process is working. The code also specifically has a section that talks about a committee that we convene for discussion of revisions. And that includes representatives from the SA and the GPSA as well.
Well, thank you very much, Christine. I appreciate you taking time here today. I know I was involved in the process of the code change, and you know, I just want to ask one question, and it's very simple. It's simply, at the time, there's a lot of conversation around fraternities and sororities and student orgs and how this might impact them. Looking at the data there, 10 student org responses. Is that on par with what you've seen? Mm-hmm. And are you seeing the process enacted fairly similar to what you had in the past? Has there been any complaint around the equity as well mm-hmm. of student org and individuals?
So the data, I will say, is a snapshot in time for us. It also is a very strange year, right? I want to acknowledge that too, is COVID really just throws everything off, right? And so I think seeing what the reports look like for the next couple of years will be an indicator for us of what are the trends and the more valuable data. For our student orgs, right, student orgs are always a little bit more complex, right? Because even though you're talking about individual behavior, you're also acknowledging that within a group environment, that behavior could be altered, right? Could be impacted by external factors. And so we are using those informal processes to engage lots of different partners, including stakeholders as well. So it could be, for example, in a social fraternity, engaging their headquarters folks, right, is an important aspect of it because they also have the recognition process for that specific organization. So I think it's a work in progress. The spring semester is a time we see a lot more potential activity because of spring recruitment, right? But I think that it's a work in progress, I would say. Yeah.
Thank you, Christina. Thank you all so much for the great questions. I know that Christina is available. I've had many interactions with her, so if you have questions following this presentation and conversation today, I will extend Christina, as I know she would anyways. Feel free to reach out and follow up with additional questions that you might have. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Always happy to, you know, answer any questions about how the code is going, and very open to feedback. So please definitely share that. I appreciate it. I really do.
Thank you so much. And you're welcome to stay for the rest of the meeting.
Thanks, yeah.
All right, we'll move on to our business of the next item on our business of the day, which is UA Resolution 5. I will turn this over to Deborah, who is here, to UA Resolution 5.
Thank you, and I'm stuck. remind everyone, this is my first time, so please help me out with the language. So at the last meeting, UA Resolution 5 was brought forward on in support of the Faculty Senate resolution for a new natatorium for Cornell to be added in to the Do the Greatest Good campaign. And I have not received any comments in the last 2 weeks. So at this meeting, I would like to bring the resolution forward for a vote.
All right. So we have the conversation around the resolution. So we can open the floor to discussion around UA Resolution 5. Yes, Duncan.
I guess I'll kick it off just by supporting bringing it to a vote and supporting the resolution. I co-signed it for a reason. By also preferencing that in the week, or excuse me, 2 weeks since our previous meeting, the student assembly started putting, or myself and other, with support of other student assembly members, putting together a resolution in support of this as well. A number of students have come forward expressing extreme interest in this and have highlighted their want to discuss it in front of the student assembly, support and other factors. Everyone from people who just casually swim, who talk to their freshman rep, who then brought it up, to captains of multiple teams like the water polo team and the swim team, expressing like deep, deep concern to what Cornell could look like without a pool, without an auditorium. Still getting used to that word. I think right in the room, I don't want to speak for anyone's, you know, but I think there's a lot of support from a lot of faculty for obvious reasons. This is a Faculty Senate initiative, but I can affirm that there's a lot of students who feel just as passionate and just as ready to speak up for it. So if there's any reservations on that, I'd be more than happy with connecting it with some of the people who would really, really feel the benefit of this. So.
Thank you, Duncan. I recognize you.
I can just, if you guys want to give a presentation, I'm sure Senator Ashley Newman would share her slides, which are amazing, with you guys. So if you want, I can ask her.
She's coming to our meeting.
Okay, so she's going to do the presentation.
I'm usually ahead.
All right. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yes, Ian.
I'd just like to say, in support of the resolution, as a matter of institutional pride, it is embarrassing that the swim team has to host visiting teams at the Ithaca College Natatorium and not on Cornell's campus.
Not only for the reason that Senator Newman had raised last meeting, but also because of those that Representative Akishola had brought up just now, I'm very much in support of this resolution.
Ms. Holland.
Can I mention a vote?
Second.
We have a call to question. We have a second. So with that then, all those in favor of UA Resolution 5, either raise your placards or your Zoom hands. Or click the yes, also works. There you go. All right, I'll let Casey get the count. Let me know when you're ready.
I think it is. Online and
3, 4, 6, 8, 11, 16. 16. I don't have my placard, but I'm voting yes.
Yeah, no, I saw it.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead. Lower those. Any opposed?
Yes, unanimous.
And then abstentions. All right, so with that, UA Resolution passes. Resolution 5 passes. Thank you very much, Deborah, for your work on that. Yep. All right. So with that, just trying to remember, we moved the late edition now. All right, so now we would move to UA Resolution 3, which was added as a late addition to the agenda. And I have a copy of that that I will share on the screen here. This is correct.
I sent it.
Oh, is it different from the one Ian had sent me?
Probably not.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, this is the old most recent one from the box folder.
All right. So
from the site committee box folder?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Okay. So I will share my screen with that. And I will make that a little bit larger so folks can see it. All right. And I will turn the floor over to Jacob and Ian or whoever.
So as everybody remembers, this resolution was originally introduced back in November. After some discussion, it was referred to the site committee, which held a hearing on the 1st of February with a couple guest speakers, including representatives from R5 operations, from grounds, as well as from the Big Belly Smart Solutions Waste Management Company. After some fruitful discussion, I think, we brought this resolution back to the University Assembly. And all three of us co-sponsors are still in support of it. The reason we recommend that we reenact this resolution is threefold. Firstly, it reduces Cornell's carbon footprint. It will reduce fuel costs by not necessitating the pickup of empty bins, as well as fewer pickups due to animal concerns. It will also reduce non-salvageable recycling lost in the stream by making it easier for people to identify what is trash and what is recycling and not cross-mixing those streams. Secondly, it will increase the convenience for faculty, staff, and students by making bins more visible and putting them in more data-optimized, centralized locations to make it easier for people to throw away trash and recycling while they're going about their days. Additionally, one of the challenges that we have with the current bins is because they're lightweight and portable, they've been moved over the past 8 years. These things are heavy. They won't be able to be moved, at least not by anyone other than the ground staff. And they'll also enable us to actually develop a accurate map of where all the waste receptacles are on campus, which is something that does not exist right now, which means that when our grounds staff have to go around and collect trash, it's essentially tribal knowledge and internal processes. If those employees quit, then that knowledge is lost. And lastly, this resolution will reduce Cornell's fuel and labor costs and burn rate. One of the things that's been seen at other schools that have modeled this approach is in the first year, there's been an 80% reduction in the amount of pickups that have had to be done by to collect the trash. It'll also allow us to reallocate that labor that would ordinarily be used to collect trash to other uses, such as beautifying the campus or addressing other concerns that the grounds department sees as necessary. Now, one thing that we discussed last time we discussed this resolution in here was that the campus sustainability office is opposed to it. The reason being, it does cut counter to the campus sustainability's office long-term strategy, which it involves reducing waste on campus by some measure of making it less convenient for people to dispose of waste and do recycle. The campus sustainability office and the sponsors of this resolution share the same goal, which is to reduce Cornell's carbon footprint overall and make this a more sustainable campus. However, the way we go about it is different. I, and I believe my co-sponsors, believe that in order to recruit more fighters to the fight against climate change, you need to find ways to enable people to do it without causing them great inconvenience in their daily lives. I also believe that if you do cause that inconvenience, you will turn away people who would otherwise be eager and happy warriors in the fight against climate change. So for the foregoing reasons, I recommend that the University Assembly adopt this resolution, and I'll turn it over to my co-sponsors if they have anything to say, and also stand by for questions.
I'd love to just say something very short and very sweet on this. We've talked a lot about this resolution, and I am really excited to possibly talk more about it today. I just would like to say the bottom line. We're going to support a better, more beautiful, more sustainable Cornell for less money in the long run. It's concurrent with the long-term mission of sustainability at Cornell. It meets concerns of natural elements, from squirrels taking out trash to the elements, which was brought up last time as a concern, something addressed by Big Belly is not a concern given they have functioning units in the Arctic Circle in some Nordic countries. This is something that most of our Ivy League competitors have. It's something we have in the APA Commons. I think undoubtedly there's an opportunity to really take a step in sustainable infrastructure in everyone's day-to-day life that has a lot of net benefits that Ian laid out, and I can just affirm my support for that fully.
Hi, Jacob.
Yeah, thank you guys. Summed it up really well. So, folks, this is a no-brainer, okay? It's time to put our money where our mouth is in terms of sustainable development and environmentalism. The university talks a good game, and they do a lot in terms of investing in our sustainable future that I, as an environmental policy major, I certainly appreciate. When it comes to the sustainability office, I think that they are misguided in their approach. They are funding currently recycling proms, dinners at the Statler that don't do squat when it comes to addressing waste management issues on campus. They are sending memes on Instagram and investing time into that when that does nothing in terms of actually addressing serious issues of sustainability that we have on this campus. If anybody who is, and I'm sure Brandon can attest to this, walked near the dining halls after dinner and seen the astronomical amounts of waste and litter that surrounds the dining halls, I mean, it is mind-boggling. And as a sustainable campus, as somebody who is passionate about sustainability and sustainable development, as well as passionate about beautifying our campus, I take great pride in the way that our campus looks, and that's part of the reason why I formerly served as chair of the site committee and continue this work. But we have to make investments. I know that this might come with a small cost, but I think that the cost to our surrounding environment that is critical in supporting our living laboratory mission, that is something that I myself have been very privileged to have experienced as an environmental sustainability major here at Cornell. Where we use the natural environment in our education process, whether it be labs or field biology courses, which were integral in myself and everyone else in my department's education. So this is critical to even suggesting that we are going to remain a sustainable institution. We need to make these investments. We are falling behind. This has become, as one of our folks who had joined us at the hearing had mentioned, this is becoming the standard across colleges in the United States of America. We see it in Berkeley, we see it at the University of Florida, but more importantly, we see it at schools like Brown and MIT and Boston University that get astronomical amounts of snow. So this is a no-brainer. I am strongly in support of this resolution.
I just want to recognize you, James, in just a moment. We have a question that came in on the chat from Caroline Levine asking what was the statement around the sustainability office being opposed to this? Can you please expand upon that statement?
Yeah, I can speak on that. So this is something that we've discussed with the campus sustainability office, principally Sarah Carson-Zemenick and Sarah Brzezinski. Over the past several months. And we've had some healthy back and forth, but ultimately they do not favor this proposal because it does run counter to their strategy, which is to reduce the number. One element of it is to reduce the number of waste receptacles on campus in order to try to, the idea is that it makes it, by making it harder for people to throw away their waste, people think twice about consuming that waste or bringing that waste to campus in the first place.
And the just to jump off that as well, in our conversation in the hearing, there was specifically a question and answer around that. A conversation ensued about students' concerns that have been going on for a while about the number of waste receptacles in specific parts of campus. A common one is West Campus in the move-in period has extra literal dumpsters rolled in next to the dorms because there's so much waste. And then throughout the year, there normally isn't as many cans because they can likely be moved. Again, we don't have a map, so we can't tell exactly what happened to them. That said, a conversation ensued about the psychology behind this, right, in which it was examined by Big Belly that they actually already have an answer for this. It has to do with their mechanism of opening and closing the machines. I believe we talked about this, Richard, about the concept is if there's less waste receptacles and you have trash, you think more about that, you have consumed something with trash. The response to that by Big Belly is you have to also then pursue a new action of opening and closing a relatively noticeable door. There's a more accessible pad for people who on the floor for people who have issues with that, for whatever reason, accessibility issues with that. But both then incur an additional action to throw something away, not just tossing in a waste basket, you know, like your Kobe or something, but actually putting it in there. Sorry, yeah, I had to make that basketball reference. But The response there is they've met the psychology, they've done the research as well, and it likely is a matter of perspective.
Now, Britton, I came to the question. Thank you, Ian and Duncan, for that response there, and to James.
Yeah, so mine's less of a question now because they've kind of gone over the logic behind this, but I just want to say something that I raised at the GPSA meeting yesterday, which is basically that the reasoning behind the current lack of trash cans is very like idealistic and well-intentioned, but flawed in logic. Obviously, the thinking is that with fewer trash cans, students will produce less trash or carry it off campus to dispose of it. So the issue in my eyes is that while the vast majority of students might, you know, still dispose of their trash despite their lack of receptacles, like being a law student, you know that. I know that legislation should not be, you know, aimed at the best of us in society, or even the vast majority, but aimed at preventing the harm from like less scrupulous members of society. So if there's a 5% or even a 1% that is prone to, you know, opts to litter instead of hanging onto their trash, then I think legislation should be, you know, aimed at preventing the harm from those students rather than, you know, just the good work that's done by the vast majority of other students. This is an open question. Does anyone really believe that having fewer trash cans is going to make students think twice on Amazon before, like, you know, ordering more packages? I feel like it's idealistic, like, and I totally get where they're coming from. And I think, as Ian said, like, we're all looking for the, you know, we're all aiming for the same thing. But I just think in practice, I don't think students are going to, you know, consider the lack of trash cans or waste receptacles before, you know, purchasing Amazon boxes and, or, you know, items on Amazon. Because Ian said yesterday that a big concern is the kind of, you know, how many Amazon packages and Amazon boxes are produced by the student population. So, yeah, basically, while it's well-intentioned, I think this current approach is kind of ripe for abuse that can be prevented by sophisticated, more numerous receptacles.
Yep. Any responses to you?
Yeah, I will add that the second-to-last resolve clause on the screen currently addresses their complaint of having too many waste receptacles. And we're not suggesting here that we're going to start putting a garbage can on every single corner and in every room. We're suggesting that the waste management and the facilities department actually streamline this initiative such that they know where most garbage is accumulating and placing those garbage cans in a strategic location with respect, you know, whether it's next to near a dining hall, outside, beside a bus stop. I remember that they had mentioned was a key point in which they find a lot of litter. So placing them in those locations. We're not suggesting by any means that we should expand drastically the number of garbage cans. Rather, taking the ones that we currently have and making them or replacing them with Big Belly or whatever other smart waste receptacle company. Big Belly had the most cost-effective option for us. That's why we've spoken with them quite extensively. But we encourage the university administration to really pursue whatever company, even if it's internally, you know, embracing that living laboratory model. And perhaps getting funding from the state government for research initiatives as it pertains to waste management that can be scaled up to larger cities across our state. That's just a suggestion, a potential example. But we are encouraging no such thing as it relates to increasing the number of garbage cans, simply replacing them with more sustainable garbage cans that will allow our collection process to be streamlined, saving gas, time, money, etc.
Thank you, Jacob. I just want to acknowledge that for the sake of time, we are at about 5:42. We do have assembly reports still, and noting that this resolution has been submitted as a late addition without giving folks time to review. As much of the conversation last time was around some of the verbiage and the tone of the resolution, less about some of the content of it. So just want to be respectful of time there, and I'll turn to Caroline now. Question.
Hello from Marrakesh, Morocco, everybody, where it's 20 minutes to midnight. And my Wi-Fi is very bad, so I come in and out. But I'm very nervous about any proposal that goes directly against what the Campus Sustainability Office proposes. And that's because they do a lot of research in that office. And there's been a lot of research on, you know, the ways that I'm blocking the name of the kind of research it is, but when you design things so that people behave in certain ways, as opposed to just telling them to recycle more or telling them to save waste. Those have been the most effective strategies in food waste on the campus, has been changing the design of the dining halls. So I don't think that we should just dismiss what the campus sustainability office has to say. And it feels a little like people are saying, well, how could that be? But I think maybe we need to look at that research, what it is that they're basing their understanding on, because I think usually they're very grounded and very, very knowledgeable. So next time or whenever it comes up for vote, I'd like to see their full response to this proposal.
I want to give time for...
Can we respond to that?
I'd like to save time. We're getting a lot of long comments, you know, so we're expanding out quite a bit. I want to hear from the assemblies because, as you acknowledge, this has been brought back, and we'll have to have a period of time to wait before vote, so I want to hear feedback is important. Precedent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a valid concern, but I think that at the same time, it would be more beneficial to actually know where the garbage cans on campus are. Like, I don't think that you can do ample research without knowing like where the garbage cans are and like how the traffic reflects that. And I think that this is a good idea to like establish like it, basically like a clean slate. Like if you're going to do it right, do it right. And so, you know, making sure you know where these are and using sustainable technology. I have support this definitely. I think it's a good idea.
Thank you, Preston. And Connelly, did you have a comment as well?
Oh, I just had a quick question. Is there a way we can access the resolution?
I did put it into the Zoom chat, but
it's in the box.
It's in mm-hmm. the.
I didn't see it in the box.
I can put it in the box.
Okay. Thank you.
Daisy, we'll put that in there. Any other questions or comments from the assembly before we turn back to the sponsors? Turn that to Duncan, if we did.
Yeah, I can just run through that specific point that was first raised. So really three points of note that came from our conversation in the hearing, which, again, there's a lot of resources available if you missed it. So if you have any real interest in that conversation, I highly recommend you go about that. Three points I noted specifically about the research they did. First one is 8 years old, okay, almost a decade old. I understand there's a lot of conversation about how we look at research, how we think of people thinking about consumption. But I think it's pretty clear to say in the past decade, there's been fairly significant changes in public opinion, policy, and I don't want to go on kind of whim and make assumptions, but I can say that, you know, from an academic perspective of a student, if I was trying to pull research on something that was 8 years old, I would get a lot of criticism from my faculty. So I think there's some possible room to bring hesitancy there, but that's fine. Second, that research came from an essay initiative. I checked back with the essay archivist. I talked to Gina and Wendy at the time, trying to dig up some of that old information. It was pretty sparse and it was pretty hard to come by. But it was referenced by sustainability that it was through an essay initiative, right? It was through shared governance addressing an issue that the community had reported and through acknowledgement that policies were failing in the day-to-day. That's the reason that first examination happened, that determined where the current locations should be that we've now determined are not in process. And finally, which is kind of interesting, I think, from it, is that the focus of sustainability at Cornell is not this currently, right? There's a borehole project we've heard a ton about that's incredible. There's earth source heating. There's cooling through Cayuga Lake. There's specifically in waste, interestingly, their focus, and they admitted this themselves, is internal waste, is waste in dining halls, how we can compost in dining services. Something, Brandon, you talked about, I believe, last time when this was brought up. They talked about waste of like biohazardous materials by faculty and research initiatives. They're not currently, at least from our conversation that we had in that hearing, looking at, well, if we put the trash cans in the corner of this room, how does that affect people? Or if we open the door, how are people going to think about the coffee cup they just bought? There were conversations they're having about sustainability with consumption. They're having conversations about how do we get people to stop buying Starbucks in the paper cups and have them start bringing their mugs from home. But the conversation about where trash cans are, where consumption is, exactly what this resolution is aimed at, hasn't happened for almost a decade and is based off of initiatives from shared governance. So I implore anyone who has questions or concerns with sustainability Cornell's approach to take a look at why they've come to this approach, and it's because it's not their focus currently. I understand their concerns, and I think we've outlined a lot of reasons why we believe that this should be a concern of theirs. This is a community concern and why we have an effective solution towards it. But I don't necessarily agree with the assertion that we are going against sustainability at Cornell or we're doing so for any sort of malice reasons. Similarly, I wanted to address what Brandon raised, the point of our previous conversation, taking that tone. If you get a chance, reread the resolution. We took that to heart. That was really a core of our mission, was to make sure this was something that addressed community, addressed concerns, and just sustainability. Not something that was a soapbox, not something that was a pedestal, excuse me, but something that was infrastructure. So I appreciate those concerns. And yeah.
Thank you very much, Duncan. And just again, for the sake of time, I might entertain a motion to table this resolution to allow folks time to provide feedback to the sponsors so that it can be brought up, or welcome the other discussion or conversation.
Motion table.
We have a motion to table.
Second.
We have a second from Damien. Do we have any, all those in favor for tabling?
Is your time to make a point?
I'd like to go ahead and keep us moving here. We have a motion on the floor.
It pertains to the motion.
We'll have a discussion on the motion.
Just a question about procedure, do we have to table or can we vote since this was already raised in assembly before and referred back to committee?
In this particular instance, I would say we would not be able to vote on this. One, the resolution isn't actually in the correct format to be submitted fully. It doesn't have line numbers on it and it hasn't been added in there. And then two, just from the chair's discretion, I do ask that we give that response because nobody has had a chance really to read this resolution. Everyone's looking at it on the screen. So providing that feedback to you is important.
Can we then table to the next meeting?
Absolutely. Not to table it definitely. We send it back to committee. If those remember, the committee has worked on it and brought it back for us to then hear feedback and receive comment so that it can then be brought back to the floor to be voted upon. Any other discussion in regards to the motion to table? Seeing none, all those in favor of tabling the motion, raise your placards. And I'll stop the screen share so we can see those on Zoom.
I think we're done, it is there now.
Yep. I see 4 or 5 on the Zoom.
11.
And those opposed?
That's just the 5.
And abstentions?
11-5-1.
All right. And with that, the motion to table passes. So the motion has been tabled. We'll now move to our next item on the agenda, assembly report. So we'll move to the student assembly.
Real quick. Okay, so for student assembly, we don't have too much going on right now. Since our last meeting, we passed a resolution just solidifying our referendum process on campus, which just hadn't been updated for a while. So we had a resolution on that. We passed that. We took the resolution from the GPSA commending Wendy for her work on campus. We also passed that. And then we passed the amendments to our election rules and then solidified our election calendar, which actually started yesterday. So we have our first today. We have our first info session for elections, and they'll be happening the next month for the next student assembly representatives. But that's what's going on with us.
Any questions for Anneli and the student assembly? All right, we'll move to the GPSA.
Yeah, not a whole lot of things to update on. We are working towards similar resolutions to both Resolution 3 and Resolution 5, so I think that's been kind of our main focus at this point.
Just a comment from the chat to make sure to identify, and I'll do better with that to identify folks before they speak, so it's hard to tell. Sorry, go ahead there, Preston.
Yeah, no, that was it. That's all I had.
Any questions for Preston? Seeing none, we'll move to Jessica with the Employee Assembly.
Briefly, we had Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer Mary Opperman at our last EA meeting, and she was very gracious in sharing her time and her thoughts on where employees are, Cornell staff are now, and where they might be going. great conversations with members. Our elections committee has also begun planning our spring election, and I believe our calendar will be lined up with the employee elected trustee election, so to give better visibility to both. I can say that our welfare committee had a presentation, Deborah presented, about the UAR5, and I know they're considering a similar resolution.
Thank you. Any questions for Jessica? All right, that will turn to Eve for the Faculty Senate.
Sorry it was late, everybody. It was unavoidable. Quickly, we have Senator Newman is bringing the revised moratorium resolution to a vote, so she'll show the revisions, and also we have the support of the Emeriti, so that resolution will be re-presented for a vote. We have Vice President Donica Varner. I think she's going touring the different assemblies, so she's coming to introduce herself to the Faculty Senate. And we have a pilot program that's going to be presented to the Senate because it has implications not only for students, you guys, and also faculty. And this program is a pilot program to give a flat rate price for academic materials. It's meant to advantage financial aid students so that they have predictable costs for their academic materials. And it's, I think it's going to be kind of controversial for the faculty, so I want them to be able to give feedback early before the pilot program gets going. And the last thing is we're bringing more Senate reports to the discussion of the part-time bachelor's program for non-traditional students.
Any questions for you? Yes, Thomas.
What are academic materials? Textbooks?
Textbooks, paint material, anything okay. that a student needs for course.
For any course?
Any course on campus. They're okay. Trying to negotiate with the publishers so that they can have a perpetual electronic access to a digital library, but when digital materials are not available, they will buy hard copies, paint, whatever it is, but it's to help those students on aid.
Thank you. Duncan?
And this is the instant access pilot program, I believe.
No, it's actually a different program. Okay. It's more extensive, but it's built on the data from the instant access, and they have more data from other examples of what they're trying to achieve, but it sounds pretty fantastic if your students want.
Yeah, I remember that was brought up to the Student Assembly, the Instant Access Program, and it had a lot of advantageous elements to students who have financial concerns and students with disabilities relating to accessibility concerns.
And I will say that also, yes, accessibility, access, and what happened with instant access, it was dependent on faculty to initiate it, and students still were negotiating whether they could afford materials or not. None of that. On day one, everybody has access to all their academic materials.
Thank you.
Thank you. Preston?
Just a motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes.
We have a motion to extend. Do we have a second? Seconded by Jacob. Any opposition? Seeing none, we'll extend the meeting by 10 minutes. Thanks for keeping an eye on time there, Preston. I appreciate that. Any other questions for Eve? All right, we'll move to committee reports, starting with the Executive Committee. The Executive Committee was very, very brief, but basically I wanted to just let everyone know that on March 25th, I will be presenting to the Board of Trustees about what we are doing here, and I would greatly appreciate your perspectives on what is really important to provide them. Obviously, I've been here and I've listened, but that's through my ears and my lens, and I think it's important that I am there to represent all of you. So I would encourage you to send me thoughts, perspectives, ideas around what would be important for them to hear about the work that we do here. And you can do so by email directly to me or to the Executive Committee, however you would prefer to provide that feedback. Anything you'd like to add, Richard? Any questions about that? It's a very brief presentation. Yes, Eve?
I was going to ask how brief.
It's a very brief presentation. I think it's something in the 5 to 8 minutes.
6 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Gotta be snappy and fast.
All right, wonderful. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, we'll move to the Codes and Judicial Committee.
Oh, sorry.
I just have a question. Did you want to mention to the reception with the executive
committee of the board? I hope everybody saw the invitation, that there is an invitation to attend a reception with the Board of Trustees on that Wednesday, March 23rd, either around 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 4?
At 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock in the afternoon at the Statler. That's a great opportunity for you to provide perspective of what we're doing here in the University Assembly from your lens as well, directly to the Board of Trustees, and they are very open to conversation and questions.
And it's the Executive Committee of the Board.
Oh, goodness.
So at the great arena for our conversation. Definitely encourage you to attend. I am unfortunately unable to attend, so I hope that many of you will be able to be there to represent. All right, we'll move now to James for the Codes and Judicial Committee.
Thank you. So first thing is that I'm going to bring forth in the next meeting a resolution for discussion drafted by Richard Bensel and myself in consultation with the rest of the CJC. So in the interest of time, I'll just run through it real quick just to introduce it just generally. Basically, the current bylaws state that by delegation from the Assembly, the committee, meaning the CJC, will review any proposed motion related to campus code of conduct and recruitment and appointment of members to the university hearing and review boards. And then it goes on to say that the committee may propose, review, and amend resolutions as it deems appropriate and must approve resolutions referred for its consideration before they can be advanced to the Assembly for a vote and for debate. So these things either, you know, formally or informally have been either discarded or rendered irrelevant now by the code changes. So there's two main changes that we're, that we've discussed. Firstly, obviously, University Hearing Review Board is no longer appropriate. It's been changed to the panel to reflect the new student code of conduct rather than the campus code of conduct. All the language implicating the CJC and formal recruitment and appointment of UHRP candidates should be removed because now the recruitment and appointment of UHRP members is not delegated to the CJC, but to the director of the OSCCS, executive committee, and the assemblies and senate themselves. So just based off kind of what the CJC did earlier, just after last summer and during last summer, we're going to say something along the lines of the CJC will facilitate communication between the executive committee and the Senate and assemblies by delivering instruction and advice from the executive committee to the Senate and assemblies regarding timing and method of soliciting applications and making appointments. So basically, we were a go-between between the executive committee and the Senate and assemblies themselves, basically delivering advice and instruction on the timeline for appointments and method of soliciting applications from the student population and whatnot. Additionally, the name Codes and Judicial Committee was rendered, inappropriate by the new campus code or new student code of conduct. So to reflect the less judicial form of the review disciplinary process, we feel that Codes and Judicial Committee is no longer an appropriate name. And we're going to discuss this in the CJC meeting this coming week, but one of the names we've talked about is Campus Codes Review Committee, and you'll see why in a second. So currently the CJC is tasked with formally reviewing any proposed approving resolutions referred for its consideration before they could be advanced to the Assembly. This hasn't come to fruition under the Student Code of Conduct this year. So we've discussed basically designating the, in addition to the aforementioned changes, designating the CJC as the body which can review any discrepancies in disciplinary action or application of behavioral standards among the entire Cornell campus population, based on kind of concerns that were raised and probably still exist when the code transitioned from the campus code to the student code of conduct. So that's something we talked about. The formal framework for hearing these, hearing these issues and investigating them and whatnot probably won't be fully formalized before the end of the year, but we definitely want to get a rough framework in place. Just to run through the changes that I've talked about: name change, delineating, clearly clarifying the CJC's role in as far as the UHRP appointment process, and then clarifying the role under the new code in terms of concerns in terms of application of behavioral standards among the entire Cornell population. So if anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to hear those.
Thank you, James. Any question for James? Sounds like a busy meeting there, lots of work to be done. I encourage folks, if any of those items are of interest to you, to, as always, to join in the committee. I have a special affinity for the Codes and Judicial Committee. I was a big part of it. So I know it's great work that can be done there. So encourage folks to join in that conversation. All right, with that, we'll move on to our next committee is the Campus Welfare Committee. So I'll turn the floor to Deborah.
Thank you. As you know, we have just finished up UA Resolution 5. Thank you all for that. And we are moving on and starting to think about the other thing we really wanted to work on this year, which is crisis response and communication. So we're going to be doing a bit of work on that this month. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah? Seeing none, we'll move to the Campus Committee on Infrastructure, Technology, and the Environment. Turn it over to Ian.
No updates for site right now.
All right. And any liaison reports? Yes, Ian.
A brief report from the Campus Planning Committee. They had their last meeting on February 25th, and the principal topic of discussion was construction of a new sports and recreational facility. As many of you are aware, Barton Hall is quite old. And the university, you know, for the past several years has been looking to replace that with a new 96,000 square foot building, which is roughly the same footprint as what Barton Hall has right now. Still a couple details to be ironed out. Chief among them is site selection. It was originally conceived that this facility would occupy a space near the new baseball stadium being built on Game Farm Road. But that is being ruled out largely because of accessibility and safety issues. Students who don't have cars would probably not be able to get there very easily. Additionally, there are lots of students who use Barton Hall late at night. And the idea is that you would want a facility that's relatively central on campus that which through which people can get to on foot and, you know, in a as most of a well-lit area as possible. So the leading candidate for a site right now is where the alumni athletic fields are. I will note that this site selection does run counter to the campus master plan. But the general consensus at the planning committee meeting was that the campus master plan was conceived a decade ago during pre-COVID times and the university's requirements have changed. So assuming that the seismologists and other architects find no issues with the site due to its proximity to the synchrotron. This will probably be the site selected for the new athletic complex. And there are currently bids being solicited by different architects with 7 under consideration right now.
Thank you, Ian. We have a question from Richard.
Quick question. What happens to Barton Hall?
What specifically happens to Barton Hall was not discussed, but if I might speculate, I will say that after the new facility is completed, it will be torn down and that space will be repurposed for something else.
Be torn down what?
I don't know what.
Other questions for Ian? Interesting. Oh, go ahead, Ian.
Sorry, I was just going to ask what the seismologist concern with the synchrotron is and whatnot.
Well, to be clear, I don't know if there are any concerns yet, but it was noted that possible concerns about construction on top of an area where the synchrotron runs underneath, there might be some issues, but no issues have been identified yet.
What was that, Thomas?
You don't want to collapse the synchrotron. It's a big tunnel runs under a long block. So you can't dig down either. That's another issue.
Yes, Preston.
So have they talked anything about a new natatorium in this like conversation, a new like athletic complex? Is that just not something they're worried about?
I was wondering when that was going to go.
You know, it's funny, given the timing of what has been going on in the assembly, but no, the discussion of the natatorium did not come up in conjunction with the construction of the new athletic complex.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, they'll have to know.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Ian? Any other liaison reports? All right. Well, seeing none, then I would entertain the motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn. Do we have a second?
Second.
Any opposed? Seeing none, meeting is adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.